Morning. How many people were not able to go to my two lessons yesterday? I guess I should repeat those first. What do you think? No, I won't do that. We had two lessons that are sort of in the same track before this one. The first one dealt with issues of biblical canon, that is, what books belong in the Old Testament and what books belong in the New Testament. And then the second lesson dealt with the transmission of the text. How is it that the Bible came to us, and how can we understand that it's trustworthy? And this particular lesson deals with the issue of translation, how to choose a translation that's right for you. There are two handouts. The first one we're going to look at has at the top of it an introduction to word study. Did everybody get a copy? If you did not get a copy, make sure you raise your hand. There are some extra copies around, I hope. I'm hoping there's some that are being passed around there. And then the second one that we're going to look at afterwards is called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. If you did not get a copy, get close to somebody that you can share with. I'm not going to read everything word by word, but I'm going to use it as a guideline. The first one that says an introduction to word study, if you would pick that up, we're going to glance at a few opening lines, and then we will proceed from there. Most students know the Bible only through translation. And I suspect most of us deal with English translation. If you are a native speaker of another language, Portuguese, Spanish, German, whatever it might be, your initial exposure to God's Word would not necessarily be through an English translation, but through whatever your native tongue is. But most people know the biblical text in translation. While reading and studying the Bible via translation profits the student, the reader, we must note that every translation inherently involves an element of interpretation, perhaps even supposition on the part of the translator. Now, why do I say that? When you start with an English translator, translation of any kind, in English or German, or whatever it is you start with, whatever native language that you speak, whatever language that you're comfortable in, and whatever Bible that you're reading in that native language, you are most always one step removed from the original, at least. Sometimes more. The original languages of the Bible, Hebrew and Aramaic in the Old Testament and Greek in the New Testament, were the original languages of the Bible. A.T. Robertson, a famous Greek scholar, has said, "The Greek New Testament is the New Testament. Everything else is translation." And he's not trying to be mean or to be critical. He's just trying to be observant. Now, here's what we need to understand from the standpoint of how we evaluate any and all translations, especially English translations in this particular setting. Look at the very next paragraph. Bruce Metzger, who is a student of the biblical text, taught at Princeton for many, many years before he passed away in the last few years, cites Morgenthaler in his book that Mr. Metzger did in Lexical Aids of the Greek New Testament, said there are 5,436 distinct Greek terms in the New Testament. Now, that's not a large vocabulary. The average high school student maybe knows 20 to 30,000. The average adult college perhaps 50,000. And obviously we know that there are at least a million words in the English language. And so those are very, very small compared to the totality of the number of words. And the number of Greek terms is very, very small compared to the totality of other languages. And so it's a rather limited vocabulary from one perspective. But here's what I want you to think about. There's an assumption. And maybe not an assumption, it's just something we may not have thought about, that when we translate from one language into another language, we move from one word to another word, and that's the only word that will fit. That there's a literal word for word, only one word is going to fit sort of way to approach things. If that were the case, if there are 5,436 original Greek words, there would be no more than 5,436 English or German or Dutch or Spanish or Portuguese, and that's the way we would have it, and everything would be perfect. That's not the way language works. That's just not the way language works. And so part of the problem is understanding that there is no perfect translation from any original language into any receptor language. If you are a translator or you're multilingual and you go from Spanish to English or English to Spanish, you know that there are idiomatic expressions, that there are nuances in one or the other that don't translate 100% into the language we're going into. I remember many, many years ago as a student at Fried Hardeman, a student from another nation was trying to get used to our expressions, and the expression, "You're pulling my leg," made no sense to him. All he could see was somebody's tugging on a leg. What does that mean? "You're yanking my chain." That doesn't mean anything. You know, so all those are idiomatic expressions that we're used to. Well, we're used to idiomatic expressions in our own language. Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek also have unique idiomatic expressions, and we need to become familiar with them. And they don't always translate perfectly into our language or any other language. So what I'm trying to tell you at the beginning is translation is not an exact science. One of the things my dad always said was, you know, six of one, half a dozen the other. And I used to think of that as a kid. That's impressive. And then I realized, wait, six and half a dozen are exactly the same. All right? But we don't always get exactly the same when we move from one language to another language. And so that's important. Third paragraph, every translator, and so every translation takes liberties with the biblical text. Now that sounds horrible to say that, but I'm simply saying it's a matter of judgment. It's in a matter of the interpretive skill of the translator in order to decide what word's going to work best in this particular setting. Sometimes a word that's going to work best is nothing more than changing the original into an English form without defining it. The word baptism is not a translation. It's a transliteration. They started with the original term and they just put it into English without actually defining it. It means to dip, to plunge, to immerse. And so they took the original word baptizo and they just modified a little bit and brought it into the language and made it baptize or baptism. So there's no translation involved. But many times there are words that are translated that aren't just Englishized, so to speak, and they bring them into a language and there are multiple words that they can use to choose from. How do you know which one to choose? Sometimes the context determines the meaning. Sometimes the culture determines the meaning. And sometimes there are different preferences on translation committees. And so we need to understand most reliable translations aren't done by a single individual, but they're done by committees and usually hierarchies of committees. That one particular committee starts on this particular text in the Old Testament, another one starts in another particular text in the New Testament, and they work through revisions, and the revisions go through multiple committees. I know a brother in Christ that was involved in one of the translations, and he was on a committee very far removed from the ultimate committee that made the decision as to what the final text was going to say. So he's part of the process, but not directly involved. And so when you're involved in that, you've got lots of different people. Imagine us all being on a translation committee, and we're going to take some particular expression in English, and we're going to translate it into another language, some of which we are familiar with, some of which we are not. What's the best way to do that? We're going to have lots of different opinions, all right? And so in the context of dealing with translation, let me get you to realize this. The original biblical text was inspired, but the translations are not. I'm not saying they don't reflect God's inspired word, but God did not inspire by means of the work of the Spirit in the context that the word came to us originally, did not translate, bring those things into translation by means of inspired men. So none of the translators of any translation that we know today were inspired. None of them were. Going all the way back to 1611 and the precursors of the King James, none of those men were inspired. And any contemporary translation, none of those men were inspired. So what we need to understand is there is a lot of discipline that's involved in this, and there's a lot of fudge factors from one perspective, but that should make us skeptical about the final project. So let's just look at the next paragraph, just as a for instance. Twice in one verse, in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 46, we see the words everlasting and eternal. Tell me, what's the difference between everlasting and eternal? It's kind of like my dad's expression, six of one, half a dozen the other. They're synonyms. Okay, I understand that. But what's interesting is each of those terms is from the same original term. And rather than rendering that term the same way within words of each other in the same verse, the translators sought to render it as two different words. Why? I don't know. I wasn't there when they did that. But I want to know when two words that are synonyms, I want to know whether or not they came from the same root word, because that helps me understand some things in some contexts. And so what I'm trying to get you to think about from the standpoint of understanding the translation process in order to choose one is that there are a lot of variables involved. And the better informed you are, the better you are going to make a decision. So notice they use two different words. Notice in the next paragraph, in three verses in the context of Romans chapter 10, different forms of euangelion are rendered different ways. Now they all have similar meanings. the good news, the gospel, proclaim the good news or gospel within three verses of each other. But I like to know that each of those particular expressions all are rooted in the same word. But you don't always know that when you look at an English translation. The word solo and forms of that appear five or six times in the context of the scriptures. And every time but one in most translations, they all have sing in some form or sing psalms. But in the book of Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 17 and following, that word is rendered as make melody. Why is it always rendered as sing in every other instance, but only as make melody in this particular context? Well, if you know the construction of the passage there, you know that there are two lead verbs that are both imperative verbs. And immediately after that, there are five successive participles that carry out the work of those lead verbs. And one of those is another word that's already rendered as sing, adontes. And so they would have had two words rendered as sing or something close to sing in the same context. And perhaps because it was redundant, they said, we can't have another word that's rendered sing, even though it's rendered sing everywhere else in the scriptures. And so they put make melody. Well, make melody is not equivalent to sing, and it causes some confusion and allows people to think, well, I can do anything that's making melody the way I define it. But that's a confusing thing, and that's a translation issue. And so the preferences that the translators bring to the table, those are going to impact ultimately we read. Now, here's what I want you to understand. If I were going to do this, even being aware of all these faults and foibles of translations, the translation that was the Jody Apple version, and it's not coming out on the market anytime, so don't give me advance money for it. It would have the same sort of imperfections because I would have to make the same sort of judgment calls. Now, here's what I want you to look at the chart, and then we'll move on to the other sheet. This chart comes from Ralph Wiggum's and Winter's book that is called a New Testament Word Study Book and the New Testament Word Study Concordance. It's an excellent tool. But it simply indicates the level of difficulty or steps that somebody has to go through in choosing how to translate different terms. In the square box or in the rectangular that's in the middle, you see terms that are rendered as forms of love in the New Testament. You have agape, agapao, thelo, and phileo. And all of those words are rendered as love. So you look at the top one, that's rendered as 86 times as love. And these are all based on the King James Version. The middle one, the next one, 135 times. Thelo once. Now notice, of all the love terms, if you're reading a particular passage where that's the love term, you should know that's the only time in the entire New Testament that it's rendered as love. Why? Why is it rendered as love in that occasion? The translators assume that it was going to fit the context. And the last one, phileo, 22 times. So the assumption is when you see a word love, if you just assume it's the word love and it's coming from a word that's usually translated as love, is just that, an assumption. Many years ago in a Bible class, though this was not the subject of the Bible class, we read in a passage where the word wine was used, and a brother in class wanted to talk about that. So I began a few moments to explain what it meant when you saw the word wine. I said, when you see wine, you think the same thing all the time. I said, but there are multiple words that are rendered wine in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and they always think about bottled alcohol beverage in a liquor store. That's not what they always mean, but that's the common way we use them today. And so part of the problem is to take anachronistic meanings, that is, take meanings out of time in which they appeared in the biblical context, and take a meaning from another time and push it onto the biblical text. You can't go to Webster's or OED and find the word baptism and say, look, this is the way these guys interpret this today. I'm going to take that and plug that into the Bible. It doesn't work. People have looked at the word Romans chapter 1, verse 16 and following, where it says God's gospel is the power to save. And they know that the root word there is dunamis. And they know etymologically that the word dynamite is related to that. And so they take that word dynamite, which means to explode things in a horrendous fashion, and when they put that back into the term, they're doing an anachronistic definition. That word never had any concept of dynamite in the context of the first century. So that's a later definition, and we extrapolate it and go backwards. We can't do that and be consistent. Well, herein lies the problem. We take definitions that we're familiar with, and we import them or export them and put them back into biblical things, and that doesn't always work. So as you study the word love, you see it comes from at least four different terms, and this is not exhaustive. But here's what else I want you to notice. Those words that are always rendered love are always rendered something else. Notice the word agape is rendered as charity. That's the King James Version often. Now abides these three things. One of those is faith, hope, and charity in many translations. But it's also rendered as three other words. Agapao is not only related as love, but also beloved. And the word thelo, the confusing one in this, is related as desire, will, would, and 14 other words. So notice, the word thelo, if we're going to do the one-for-one translation and we had 5,436 words, every time that word appeared in the context, it would always appear by this same word. And we look at just from this chart that it's translated by multiple words, at least 18 different ones, as this chart reflects it. How could that be? Because translators have choice and they interpret things according to context. So here's what I want you to think. I'm not trying to say, oh boy, I just toss a coin and pick a translation. I simply want you to understand that translation involves a very lengthy process that involves a lot of time, a lot of deliberation, and a lot of skill. You go and pick a book off the shelf because somebody said, I like this one, you'll like it too. Well, that may be good, that may not be so good. So let's look at the other sheet that I'm looking at, the other material that's on that you can look at later. The other sheet that's called How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. All right, and we're not going to go through this in excruciating detail, but I want to work through some of that. And ultimately, we will end up at the chart at the bottom of the back page. You're free to look at that in advance, but having explained some things before we get to that, it will make a little bit more sense. So let's start. This is a summation of the book, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. It's written by Fee and Stewart. That's Gordon Fee and Douglas Stewart. It's been around for a number of years, about 500,000 copies in print the last time I heard. And I use this in teaching the class in hermeneutics at the School of Preaching, Southeast Institute of Biblical Studies. I've outlined the entire book and I have about 45 pages of single space notes just like this. And this is an outline with my twist on it from their second chapter about how to choose a translation. So let's look at some things. Obviously, the Bible has 66 books, three languages that we mentioned before, Hebrew and Aramaic in the Old Testament, Greek in the New Testament. And the yes? I have one or two here, and I don't know if there's any more, and there's some here. Thank you. If you don't have a copy of the second sheet, there are some that are going around. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. So the statement that I made before in the material that I wrote, this is all my material with the exception of the chart at the top. I don't have my name on it, but that's material that I put together. Same point that I want to bring out that I brought out before is being brought out here is when you're reading in translation, you're always one step removed, and there's an element of interpretation that might be involved. So there are different passages that I'm going to list here, but I'm not going to look at because it would take too much time to explain them. But if you read 1 Corinthians chapter 7 in verse 36, talking about a father and his virgin daughter with reference to whether or not she is going to be able to be married, let me just encourage you as your own exercise to pick up multiple translations and read that passage. And you're going to see the way it's translated is very different from one translation to another because translators were of different opinions about the initial intent. So that's important. So the question is in this context, the virgin that he's talking about, is it a daughter? Is it a wife? Is it a fiance? And each one of those different elements are chosen as the prospective meaning in different translations. So how do you know which one's right? Well, that one's pretty much a coin toss because it's tough to know. There are some things that you don't know with exacting accuracy. So let's consider as we go forward. Most people use a single translation. That's not necessarily bad. It's not necessarily the best. But here's what's suggested at the outset. Let me encourage you to use multiple translations. Now, I'm going to look at this later. This is the opening screen that I use of my software. I use Accordant software, based in Florida, by the way. And I have multiple translations and multiple tools open at the same time. And so I am very big about looking across translations. But I usually start when I'm opening a passage to study. I usually start with the original text that's digitized, that's available, and then I can compare translations across that. I'm going to encourage you to use translations in comparative Bible study as much as you possibly can with original languages, and I'll show you some steps along the way to help you know that. All right, let's drop down to the second part that says the science of translation. Number one, two choices are made by translators. The first one is textual, the actual wording of the text, and the next one is linguistic, that is, what is their theory of translation? What do you mean, theory of translation? Well, some translations, as we look at the chart on the back in a little bit, some translations aim for as literal a translation as possible. But sometimes literal translations don't work well when you bring them into another language. If I ask you in German, Darf ich ein Buch borgen, you say, what's that mean? I said, can I borrow a book? But the literal rendering of that is, can I a book borrow? You say, what kind of moron are you? That's not the way we talk. But that's the way they talk in those languages. In Matthew chapter 19, it talks about the woman taken in adultery. It's a having been put away woman. Well, we don't speak that way. And most translations don't render it that literal. So when we say a literal translation, we're saying that it's closer to a word for word, striving for one original word, one receptor word as much as possible, and keeping the same word order as much as possible. But sometimes that makes for a very stiff translation. One of the things that students learn when they're initially translating Hebrew and Greek is they're told to translate it rough from the standpoint of here's the Greek or here's the Hebrew and write the meaning of the word immediately under that, and you have a sentence, you say, well, that's not the way we do it, and then you smooth it out. So they have true translations. They'll have a rough one in which the word order is consistent with the original language, and then they'll have a smooth one in which they bring it into the word order that we're most familiar with. And so that's something that the translators keep in mind. And the other concept is, if we do that in word-for-word literal meaning, can we miss a thought? If I render an expression, you're pulling my leg, into another language, the other person who's understanding that in their receptive language shouldn't understand that as a physical tugging on a leg. Somehow or another, the thought needs to get across is, oh, you're trying to put one over on me. You're fooling me. You're joking with me. You're teasing me, all right? That's what we mean when we use that expression. That's the thought. And so imagine taking that expression, you're pulling my leg, and translating it literally, and that's where the brother that I knew many years ago scratched his head and says, I don't see that. You know, what's the point? But once he understood that that was a figurative, idiomatic expression saying, oh, you're fooling with me, you're teasing me, you're joking with me, aha, then he understood that. What the origin of that was a different story. And so here's what translators have to do. They have to make a decision between rendering something in a literal word-for-word way and still conveying the thought that was intended in that particular expression, or rendering in an expression that has the thought but may not carry over every last aspect and nuance of the literal meaning. That's a tough decision sometimes, all right? Now let me just say, and this is not part of what we need to talk about, but there are some restrictive principles that some translators that have employed in bringing the Bible from ancient languages into contemporary language that have been even more restrictive. In the today's English version, the Good News Bible that came out in the early 60s, the translators had a goal of rendering that translation into an English text that used no more than 1,800 words. That's a very limited vocabulary. USA Today and some other periodicals, they're out there electronic and in print, have a very restrictive vocabulary. Well, what do you do when you start out with 5,436 original words and you limit the receptor language, in this case English, to 14, 15, 16, 1,800 words? What do you do? You're going to have to use a lot more words in order to explain things because you're not allowed to use a vocabulary of a certain size. And so sometimes the goal of a translation is to bring it down to an age level or a reading level that everybody can understand it. And in order to do that, sometimes they will not use words that are consistent with the meaning level of the original language. You need to know that. Now let me just say going forward, and this is not explained in any of the literature I gave you, but let me just tell you, whatever translation you read from, make sure you read everything before you get to the translation from the time you open the first cover till you get to Genesis 1:1. You need to understand what they say in their preface and their introductory remarks and how to use their translation, because there they will set forth for you the mindset, the philosophical overview that the translating committee employed in making that translation. They will tell you, we were aiming for this kind of meaning. They will tell you we were aiming for a literal word-for-word meaning. Or they will tell you that we're aiming for a thought translation, which will tell you that sometimes they overlooked a literal word-for-word meaning. How do you know what translation does that? Part of that's on the chart on the back, but it's very, very cursory. But part of that is in the materials that you read. And so you need to do that with whatever translation it is that you're looking at. And you also need to know as much as possible the theological disposition of the group of people who put this translation together. Do they come from a broad range of religious people? Do they come from people who are strictly linguists and did not care much for the biblical text from the standpoint of being authorized or inspired of God, and they're just working on this as a textual translation thing? You need to know those sort of things. Does it come from a particular religious bias? And is that reflected sometimes in the translation? And sometimes that is the case. So as you look at the science of translation, translators have to make choices. What words do they use, and what's the philosophy or principle that they employ in order to get there? Now, let's go to the question of text. Some of these we're going to go through very quickly. Hebrew and Greek text. There are standardized texts that are out there that are available from any of the Bible societies. United Bible Society publishes the standardized Greek text that's used here on the screen. Nestle Allen uses the same thing. The same thing applies for the Stuttgartensia version of the Hebrew text. There are standard texts that are out there. Number B under 2, no original autographs exist. Now, this is dealing with what we talked about yesterday in the transmission of the text. We can trust, based upon the principles that we talked about yesterday, that the texts that have come down to us, the Greek texts, are very, very consistent with what the original is. But we're not dealing with the originality or the consistency and the authority and the level of accuracy of the Greek text. We're now dealing with something else one step removed from that, and that is translation text. Let me just tell you, for example, that the Latin Vulgate, done by Jerome three, 4 centuries after the time of Christ, was one of the earlier translations. There are Coptic translations and Syriac translations and so forth. And some people built their translations off a translation. And so the Vulgate, one of the earliest translations of the original Greek into Latin, was used as a basis to translate other languages. But they didn't go back to the original. And so they started translating from a translation, which means you're already a step removed from something. And so that's a difficult thing to understand, know how to proceed. So considering also the question of the text, thousands of manuscripts, we talked about that yesterday. There are differences in transmission issues. We dealt with that yesterday. And the issue of how to form the ultimate conclusion of which one's going to be the best is going to determine what's brought out under G, textual criticism, and so forth. Let's drop down to number 3, the questions of language. Again, we started with the original language, and then we're talking about the receptor language. If we're starting with Hebrew and we're going to English, English is the receptor language. If we're starting with Greek and going to English, English is the receptor language. How do I bring those words into my words today and realize that things change over time, all right? If the King James Version is your favorite translation, let me just suggest most of you are probably not using the original 1611 King James Version. You couldn't read it. Spelling doesn't look anything like the way we spell. Most of us use, if we use the King James, the 4th revision of the King James Version, which came back in 1789. So it's not even the same as the original. But even in that case, you're 170-some years removed from the original, and now we're more than 200 years changed from that, a little bit more than that, but the words have changed. If you're using an old translation, and that's not picking on it because of any other reason than because of the age of it, the use of words have changed over the course of 1611 to 1789, the 4th revision, to this time today. And so words don't always mean the same things. Even in contemporary language, words change meaning. I remember watching Leave It to Beaver, the greatest show of all time, by the way. And Wally said something about something that was neato. And June said something about, Wally, where are you getting all these words? You know, it was very, very innocent, whatever. And so Ward was trying to show how hip and cool he was by saying other words that were common to the teenagers in the late 50s. We don't use those words today, all right? That's pretty old school stuff. And so when you say, man, something's fat, we think, whoa, that's a mean thing to say. Well, we may not always mean with reference to size. We're talking about how cool it is or how neato it is, as Wally might say. So words change meaning. New words come into meaning. The word phablet. Everybody know what the word phablet is? All right, that's one of those new large phones that's a little bit larger than the size of a phone and not quite a tablet. And so they're calling them phablets already. The manufacturers can't stand that. They don't like a new term. But that word phablet is now working its way into common parlance. All right, how did that happen? Somebody took one concept, another concept, they merged them together, and you got a new term. And sooner or later, it's going to show up in standardized dictionaries. By then, it's old school. Nobody cares about it. And so words change all the time. We need to understand that. We need to be prepared for that. And so your favorite translation, whatever it might become outdated simply because language has changed. That doesn't mean meaning has changed. There's a difference when we say language has changed versus meaning has changed. So let's drop down to the bottom. Receptor language is going to be different. Now, the last thing that's on the bottom of that first sheet uses the expression historical distance. Historical distance. Well, what does that mean? Well, Anthony Thistleton, a British writer and a great writer of principles relating to philosophy and interpretation and languages, has a book called Two Horizons. And what he's talking about is, how can I look at the horizon that those folks saw 2,000 years ago during the time of the New Testament, or even further than that during the time of the Mosaic writings? And how can I look at what they saw and look at what I see? And how can I bring those two horizons together so they make sense? They lived in a different time, a different place, different set of cultures, different language, all sorts, everything about it was different. And what I'm trying to do is bring that relationship then so that it makes sense today. Let me give you an illustration that's kind of corny, but it will work if you understand it in just a moment. In the 12th episode of the very first year that Andy Griffith came about, the guys are sitting in a barbershop, and a guy gets off a bus, walks across the town square, walks into the barbershop, and talks to everybody like he knows them, and they've never seen this guy before. Well, the guy's name is later identified as Ed Sawyer, and he walks through town and he greets everybody by their name. He knows everything about him. He knows a lady who has twins who can't even tell them apart themselves. He knows which one's which, and everybody's just freaked out because this guy knows everything about him. And Barney says, he's a spy, you know? And so as the show progresses, the solution comes to this slight problem. When this guy was in the service, a buddy of his was from Mayberry. And his buddy got the hometown paper. And when he was done with it, he gave it to Ed Sawyer. And Ed Sawyer fell in love with Mayberry so much that when he and his buddy parted ways, he started getting the hometown paper. And now here it is, years later, he's been reading the hometown paper from Mayberry. And I don't know if you've ever been to one of these little places that has a paper that comes out once a week. My dad lives in Yell County, Arkansas, all right, where he's from, Havana. The sign says like 300 population. When I show up and visit my dad, it's in the paper the next week. All right, that's the kind of paper it is. Well, so this guy knew everybody in town because he knew the hometown news. And so he knew what was going on in town. He knew about so-and-so's arthritis. He knew everything about somebody. See, that's what we have to do when we read the Bible. And this is not just an issue of translation. This is an issue of interpretation. We need to read the Bible so much so that it's like we're reading the hometown news. When we read a biblical character, we know everything about him. Why? Because we've been reading and studying the Bible. We know all the background information. When we read and study about a particular place or particular event, some historical point of reference, we know all about that. Well, see, here's what the translators have to deal with. They have to see, how do I bring all this historical stuff at a distance and bring it into language that it's going to relate to people today? We sing the song, "Here I Raise My Ebenezer," and most kids are thinking, Scrooge, all right? That's not at all what we're thinking about. And so in order to connect, we have to look at the words that are translated and understand how we can bridge that distance and make it real today. And so that's our goal as understanding the biblical text, is to walk down the streets of biblical times and know all the people, places, events as if we were walking down our hometown. Now that takes a lot of work, and that's a lot of pressure on a translator to make sure that the Bible is related in such a way that that's going to happen. Now let's flip over the page and look at what's on the back. Top words, formal equivalents. This is a linguistic theory of translation. Keeping close to the form of the original language as possible in word, grammar, often referred to as a literal translation, keeps historical distance intact at all points. Sometimes that's the toughest thing to do, because you can have a literal word-for-word translation that loses thought. Again, I keep referring to the expression, "you're pulling my leg." Literally translating that does not always convey the thought. And so that's part of the issue that they have to deal with. The next one, functional, sometimes called dynamic equivalence, keeping the meaning of the original language, putting the original idioms and words into normal words in the receptor language. If I translate that literally word for word, I'm going to lose something of the meaning or the intent or the thought. So I'm going to go for the thought and leave the literalness behind. That's a judgment call. And that's something that the translators have to do when they're bringing from one language to another. So it keeps historical distance intact on some levels, but it changes things. And then the last one that's looked here before we get into some other issues is the notion of free translation. And that is just give an overview. Restate something in your own words. That's one of the things that's a student's asked to do. He's read a paragraph. It says, tell me what you just read in your own words. Sometimes that's what we see from the standpoint of quote-unquote translations. If you drop down to the chart at the very bottom, you see LB and TM. That's the Living Bible and the Message. Those are free thought, very loose paraphrases and should never even be called translations at all. Why? Because they leave so much behind. All right? And sometimes the Living Bible, for example, by Mr. Taylor, is a one-man show. I'm not saying a one man can't do a decent job. Hugo McCord did a great job of translating the New Testament, but he was eminently qualified as a linguist to be able to do that. But even then, it's just a one man show. That's not a criticism, just an observation. And so we need to understand what's the mindset that the translators bring to their work. So a free translation is translation of ideas from one language to another with less concern about using the exact words as the original, sometimes called a paraphrase, and eliminates distance, historical distance, and it still wants to be faithful from the standpoint of conveying the information, but it's a little bit looser from the standpoint of how things come across. That's important to understand. So as we explore translations, what's the theory of translation that lies behind your translation? I don't know. I don't know what translation you use, but again, we'll look at that at the very bottom. All right, what are some problem areas? And some of these we've noted already. When you look at translations to translations, when you deal with weights and measures and money, and this is just part of the background information, when you think talent and you're not thinking about biblical things, you think about a skill set. Guy can play a guitar, she can sing, they can do whatever it is, they can juggle bowling pins, they can ride on a unicycle, swallow swords and juggle bowling pins. That's a talent, I guess. All right, but that's not what the biblical concept of talent is. It's a measure of money. But it's usually a measure of money that we have no connection with. A talent is a measure of money that was equal to what a person would earn in 10,000 days worth of wages. And so 10,000 days, 250, that's 40 years worth of work. So one talent man had the equivalent of 40 years worth of wages, and the two talent man twice that, and the five talent man five times that. Well, those are huge sums of money that are lost when we say one, two, and five talents. All right? We ought to think of 40, 80, and 200 years worth of people's money. If you made $50,000 a year, the one talent man had $2 million worth of money equivalency in those days, because that's what it would take to have 40 years of earnings. Well, that's a whole different picture. And not every translation does that. And then when you come into dealing with the situation, Matthew chapter 18, verses 21 and following, with a man who was in debt for 10,000 talents, and one talent was equal to 40 years worth of wages, this man was in debt way above beyond his eyeballs. And the point was, it was an unpayable debt. And he was forgiven of that, demonstrating the grace of God. But you need to know that sort of thing, and a translation can't bring it out to you as readily. You have to be able to do some interpretive skills. So the translators have to make decisions. Do we render this particular expression in a contemporary expression? Then if we do so, who's going to miss it? If we put it in contemporary dollars and cents, people use other currency, that's going to be missing. Of course, that's an issue when you take it into their language. And so those are issues, euphemisms, in which you have one word used in the place of another word. Those are all over the biblical text. How do you do those? How do you translate those in a way that makes sense? How do you render all vocabulary in one language into another when you know that there are subtleties and shades and nuances of meaning that cannot be explained by going from one literal word to one literal word? Those are all issues that need to come into play. Again, we need to become familiar with that. The grammar and the syntax. How do we know when the construction of a particular word or series of words is used in relation to another? Let me just get you to show you the importance of context and what translators have to think about. All right? Everybody think of the word house. I think I did this the other day in one class. Everybody think of a house, all right? I suspect all of us are thinking about different houses. If you're husband and wife, you may be thinking about your own house. That's a good thing, all right? But now let's qualify that and say White House. Anybody live in a White House? Nobody lives in a White House? A couple, I see some odd, somebody, okay. So if I say house, you may think about your own house. If I think of White House, you may think of your own house. You may think of a neighbor's house. But if I say White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Washington, D.C., has it all changed the houses you're thinking about? All of a sudden, the word house has taken on a more specific meaning. And so words have meaning in context. Well, what's the context? Well, that depends. And so one word that's rendered as faith in one place means faith from the standpoint of the content that you believe. But in Romans chapter 14, verse 23, the word that's rendered faith there doesn't have anything to do with the content of doctrine, but it has reference to conscience. Whatsoever a man does in faith in that context is a matter of conscience. Well, how do you know? Context, context, context determines meaning. And the more specific the context, the more specific the meaning. So you go from house to White House in a particular location in a particular city, and all of a sudden, aha, you've given me enough information that I know what's going on there. That's what the translators have to decide how to render things. We know in this particular context that the use of this term is demanding a specific meaning. We know that because the original language hearers and readers knew that, but the people who are reading this don't. What information do we put in there to make sure that the people who are reading it in translation will have the same meaning and intent that the original people did? That's a tough skill set to master. All right? Let's proceed just a little bit more. How do you choose a translation? And here's where we get to the last few minutes of things that you need to think about. Do we want something that's theologically biased? And there are some that are out there. The New World Translation is done primarily by the Jehovah's Witnesses at the Watchtower Society in Brooklyn. The Lambs of Translation is like that. Some that are dynamic, that is, that they're a little bit more fluid in the way they approach things and are looking more for thought translation as opposed to literal. Some that are more formal and some that are freer. Now, this translation chart was borrowed. You see the gentleman who did it. You can find it online in multiple places. But he does a good job of showing a range of translations. Now notice on the extreme left, he has a word-for-word or an interlinear translation. Let me just get you to think about learning how to use whatever software you're comfortable with. I am very, very, in love with this particular software. This is the Greek text on the left-hand side, and I have an ESV tagged with Strong's on the right. And here's what I like to do. This is my preference. I like to, as much as I possibly can, do sight reading in the Greek text. But I have a translation next to it. And what's very neat, you may not be able to see this, any word that I highlight in the Greek text shows me the corresponding word in the English. So if I can't do perfect rendering and translation as I'm going through it, I can immediately see, aha, that's what it is there. But I can also do the reverse of that. I can come over and select a word in the English and see the Greek word in Greek. I like doing that. And so interlinears are good, but interlinears sometimes are very rough in the original translation they give. This is a smooth, finished translation. So I would encourage you, in whatever translation that you are comfortable with, picking one that's going to be more consistent with not just on the right-hand side paraphrase and maybe not using an express interlinear, but one that's going to be on the left side of things from the edge of thought for thought over to the right, to the left of that, because those are the ones that are going to give a fairly decent balance. Which one's going to be the one for you? Well, it may vary. There are some elderships, and this is within their prerogative, that have recommended translations, and they only pick one or two or three, usually the King James, the American Standard, New King James. But there are a lot of things that are to be said for the New American Standard Version. In some of its rendering, it's much more consistent in the Greek tenses than some other translations. For example, in the context when it says, whatsoever you bind shall be bound in Matthew 16 and then Matthew 18, it literally says in the Greek, shall have been bound. And that's what it says in the translation. It's saying it's already been determined. What it says about giving on the first day of the week in 1 Corinthians 16, it'll actually have the distributive prefix there. It says on the first day of every week, which is in the Greek text that does not always come out in English translations. And so you have to pick a translation that's going to be good for what your skill set is. But you need to know the limitations of every translation. No translation is perfect. Doesn't exist. Now, I'm not trying to burst anybody's bubbles and simply being factual. No translation is perfect. In my humble opinion, it would be great if everybody learned how to read Greek and Hebrew. That's not going to happen anytime soon. But there are enough tools out there for you to learn that you can master better understanding of your translation because of connection with the original language. Here's the best thing you need to do. If you're a carpenter, and if you're an auto mechanic, and whatever it is that is your hobby or anything that you're involved in, you know what your level of expertise is, all right? But you also need to know your level of expertise with reference to using the tools that you have, biblically speaking. If you're using XYZ translation, you need to know everything about it that you possibly can. You need to know the translators. You need to know their line of thinking. You need to know what skill sets they employed. You need to know where it lies on this particular spectrum. And you need to learn to make up for whatever deficiencies you might have. The King James translation, in every instance of the term Pascha, rendered it as Passover except for one in Acts chapter 12. Why? The king wanted the word Easter there. And guess what? The translators put it there. Shouldn't belong there. But you need to know that if you use the King James Version. But you need to know those kind of shortcomings in any translation. You need to know that there was a predilection or that was imposed on the translators by somebody outside of them, as did King James, or something that they imposed on themselves. You need to know when a word is translated from an original or transliterated from an original. And so if that's just transliteration, it doesn't tell you the meaning of the term. It just takes it from one language to another and cleans it up a little bit. And so all of those things are part of a skill set that you have to develop. And so the answer in how to choose the right translation is there's no one right translation. And you can teach the gospel from many of these translations that are listed here, providing you know what the strengths and weaknesses of those respective translations are. And this is nothing but a very, very quick overview of that concept. So we've got like 3 or 4 minutes left. If anybody has any questions or comments, I'll be glad to entertain them. And if you don't have questions, I'll have questions. How about that? Yes, sir. Speak up so everybody can hear you, sir.
The chart at the bottom, what do the numbers out to the right parentheses?
Thank you very much. Anybody want to render a guess? It's the reading level that you have to be to master that, the grade level. And so notice the message is 4.5. Somebody's in between 4th and 5th grade could get that. What's that mean? It means they've dumbed down some words. Now, I mentioned before the Today's English Version of the Good News for Modern Man that came out in the 60s. That was a translation that started with a limited vocabulary. We're not going to use any more than 1,800 words, I think, was the limit. And so they did that because they wanted a translation that was going to be able to be read by native English speakers, but also those who spoke English as a second language. And because of that, there are a lot of words that they didn't use. There's no blood in that Bible, by the way. That's one of the words they left out. It's the bloodless Bible. Well, how do you talk about all these things related to the death of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ, without having some concept of blood there? Well, that's a difficult thing. But that was a self-imposed restriction on those translators. And so that's a good point. Thank you for bringing that out. So if you look at the bottom, the key underneath that lists the acronyms NASB and so forth underneath that. But the number after that is the approximate grade level you have to be at to understand those translations. Now, this varies from place to place. There are some people who were born with a King James Bible in their hand, just to use an expression, and they grew up learning that way. But when we lived in the greater Philadelphia area, there are a lot of people who we encountered had no connection with religion other than a very formal religion and never read the Bible themselves. It was always read to them, primarily people from a Catholic Bible, and they just fell all over themselves not being able to read the King James Bible. They weren't used to the vocabulary. They weren't used to the parlance. And so if you grew up in a household that does that, you don't have to be a 13th grader, you know, out of high school to do that. You just learned it all the time. But this is across the board, average English speakers. What's the educational level that's required to grasp some of these? So again, the difficulty, the way things come across. You know, you can say things that are very simple, and you can say things in a very convoluted way. Which way is going to be easiest? Well, where are you? Where are you educationally? Where's your background? Thank you for asking that. Any other questions or comments?
I have.
Yes, speak up so we can hear you, please. And that's primarily because, especially in the English, in the Greek language, because it is very consistent in rendering tenses consistent with the original. I made a note on this. There are three places in 1 Timothy chapter 4, starting about verse 8 and going through about verse 12, where the exact same word is used three times. And once it's translated as a verb, once it's translated as a noun, and once it's translated as an adjective. I didn't catch that until several years ago when I was reading through the Greek text, and I said, hey, I've been using this word the wrong way. It says Christ Jesus is the Savior of all men, especially those who believe. And those who believe sounds like it's a verb, but it's an adjectival term. It's literally describing those who are faithful. Well, I never saw that. Why? Three times in four verses, the exact same word is rendered by three different parts of speech, and that's confusing. All right? You can have a different sense of meaning by relating it as a different part of speech. That's why I like to do this. I like to have an original language on one side and another translation on the other, and I can compare back and forth very simply to know what it is that the original said so I can see what the mindset was behind the translators to bring it into that language. So that's what I prefer to do. And so I don't recommend any single translation. I look at multiple comparative translations. And I don't have any idea how many different Bibles I have, but I have multiple, you know, iterations of multiple translations. But I like to have them all in the context of using them online. If I opened up all the text, you might drop your jaw when you saw all the electronic text that I have in my software. But I looked at like to look at them all at different points for points of comparison. Sometimes that's the best way to come up with the meaning of a text is saying, aha, it's rendered slightly different here. That pops with me more than something else. All right, let me just remind you, you are not an expert because you sat in my class. Two reasons. One, because that's not enough, and two, I'm not an expert. All right? And so this is an introduction. Pick up some good material to read about it. If you pick up the Bible, the book, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth, let me just tell you, chapter 6 in the book of Acts is worthless. You can yank it out. But there are some good things there about how to choose a translation. If you want to pick up something about the history of translations, Jack Lewis's book, The Bible, the English Bible from KJV to NIV, is an excellent approach to the mindset on a much larger scale about standard English translations. And you would do well from the standpoint of reading that. And always read the frontal material, the frontis material that's in your translations, the introductions, and the mindset that's brought out by the translators. It will help you understand your particular translation better. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.